It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If you watch cop shows on TV, or even if you're a semi-regular moviegoer, chances are you have heard this legal verse repeated over and over again.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say or do may be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to consult an attorney before speaking to the police and to have an attorney present during questioning now or in the future. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you before any questioning if you wish. If you decide to answer any questions now without an attorney present, you will still have the right to stop answering at any time until you talk to an attorney. Knowing and understanding your rights as I have explained them to you, are you willing to answer my questions without an attorney present?
Sound familiar? What you just heard are your Miranda rights. They are based on the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees the right to remain silent so that we are not compelled to speak to the police and perhaps incriminate ourselves. And they are in the news of late because within hours of the arrest of the second Boston Marathon bombing suspect, the government announced it would not read Jahar Tsarnaev his Miranda rights before questioning him. Rather, the Department of Justice said the bomber would be questioned without warnings under the public safety exemption. Here now to explain the Obama administration's interpretation of the public safety exception and how that exception works is David Harris, distinguished faculty scholar and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. David Harris, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Paul. It's good to be with you again.
If you have a comment or question for our guest or want to better understand the complexity of your Miranda rights, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. David Harris, let's begin by having you explain the origin of Miranda rights when they came out in 1966.
1966, that's right. The Miranda case is a landmark ruling by the Supreme Court of the United States in which the court said that if the police want to question you when you're in custody and if they want to use your answers against you in your trial, they must give you certain warnings before questioning you. Very important because there's a lot of misunderstandings about the Miranda rights. You got a right to have this and that. And what we just heard read correctly was simply the warnings that have to be given to people if the police want to question the person while the person is in custody and they want to use those statements to try to convict them. If the person is not in custody, they're just having a chat on the street, no Miranda warnings. If they don't want to use the statements to convict them, they want to maybe just gather information, no Miranda warnings necessary. So it's a decision that attempts to put some degree of control back in the hands of the citizen by informing the citizen that the police are questioning you, they're going to use it against you, and you don't have to talk, and you can have counsel if you want for purposes of guiding the interrogation or giving you any advice. The idea was to even up things in the interrogation room where we had known for many years that there were abuses and that there was pressure. And the whole idea of the Miranda decision was to counteract that pressure with information for the citizen so that the citizen could make an independent, considered decision. Now, we can talk a lot about whether it works that way, but that's what it was supposed to do. It was not supposed to be a requirement for being arrested. It is not a requirement for going to trial. The idea that if you don't get your Miranda warnings, they can't try you, that's just wrong. There are a lot of misconceptions. It's a very sort of limited ruling. They want to question you in custody, use it against you. They have to warn you. And in the 30 to 40 to 50 years almost since that decision, the Supreme Court has continuously shot it through with exceptions and so forth. The public safety exception is one of those.
And just so we get a little more of the backstory here, who was Miranda?
Miranda was an unfortunate guy and arrested in the state of Arizona for a long-forgotten crime. His first name was Ernesto, and he became the sort of poster child for a legal movement. I don't think that's too strong a way of putting it, that had been growing since the late 50s and early 60s to, quote, do something about the interrogation problem. There were limits in the Constitution, of course, the Fifth Amendment, which you mentioned in your introduction, that said here's what the police are supposed to be able to do or not. They cannot force you to make a statement against your will. They can't force you to be a witness against yourself. But that had been a very troubling kind of standard for the courts. Courts had been inconsistent with that. One judge ruling that this particular situation was voluntary. Another judge, same fact, same situation, would say, no, it wasn't voluntary. So this was a way of addressing what had come to be thought of as a very troublesome moment in any criminal case. Miranda was simply the vehicle for addressing this overall problem and putting these warnings in place as a way of counterbalancing the great pressure that police are able to put on suspects when they're in custody in the interrogation room.
Does the Miranda rule actually stop people from talking to the police, as some feared that it would?
No. It's a great point, because in the early going, when Miranda was first decided, you know, you had a whole host of legal commentators and others saying, sky is falling. That's the last time anybody will ever give a confession. The police will never get another statement. The whole system's going to grind to a halt, and guilty people are going to be walking out of jails everywhere laughing. Didn't happen that way, largely because these commentators and other people like that grossly underestimated how well police would learn to work with Miranda, would learn to kind of fold it into the interrogation room furniture, and would kind of work with people's natural inclination, which is to talk and explain away the various indications of their guilt. What we know now, with some careful study, is that when people are advised of their Miranda rights, and they're actually, just as in that little recitation we had, we tell them, we're going to use this against you. You know, make no mistake, this is not for you, this is for us. Still, 85% of all people say, sure, I'll talk, I don't need a lawyer. The idea that everybody does that is just a myth. When you separate people out by criminal record, and you look at people with virtually no criminal record, which is arguably the people who need the most protection, they're naive about the system, 90% of them talk. Even people with a felony record, 70% of them talk. So what we're dealing with here is a set of warnings that the police have learned to work with, cope with. They've learned how to take advantage of the human impulse to talk and explain and give their version of things. They know how to do it. And in the great majority of cases, police have no difficulty getting people to talk.
Now, if the subject was Mirandized and refused to talk, how would that affect the case against him?
Well, the case could still go forward. Remember, all Miranda does is it says the statements that are unwarned can't be used. So if the suspect refuses to talk, you can still use any physical evidence. You can still use any statements that came before, maybe made to a non-police officer, made to a police officer that when the person was not in custody. You can use any other kind of evidence. The only thing that's off the table is statements that were taken in custody without the warnings. So the case doesn't stop. It's just a question of relying on other evidence. Now, there are a certain small number of cases that are out there where the confession is the only evidence. That's troubling in a whole bunch of ways, but sometimes that's just how it is. That kind of a case could be put in jeopardy if the person was not warned and spoke anyway. You wouldn't be able to use those statements. So we get into swearing matches about who said what, was he really warned, was he not, and so forth. It's a good idea to record the whole thing, as we've said on some other shows. But the case can go forward. The arrest can go forward. The only thing that's off the table are statements made in custody where there was no warning.
And in a case like the Boston Marathon bombing and this suspect who was taken alive last Friday, Jahar Tsarnaev, that's not a key piece of evidence, whether he confesses or not, just because of so many witnesses and the circumstances surrounding the events leading up to his arrest. The police, as they had hoped, took him alive, and just a few hours later, the Justice Department says the attacker would be questioned without warnings under the public safety exception. How is that possible? How does that work?
Well, you're right. They don't need a confession out of him. I mean, there's a mountain of evidence, the videos, the statement to the guy who was carjacked, on and on and on. So it's absolutely irrelevant, actually, for this case. But when what they came out and they said is, we're not going to warn him. We are going to try to question him, and we're going to use this public safety exception. The public safety exception comes from a case from the 80s called New York against Quarles, where the Supreme Court said if there is an immediate danger to the public, the police are allowed to ask questions to alleviate that danger without giving a warning, and any answer can be used. That's the great difference there. Now, What the Justice Department was doing was preemptively invoking that public safety exception, saying we're going to question him because it's a danger to public safety. But they were actually doing that, funny enough, as the Boston police were sort of issuing the all clear, saying we got the guys. We don't think there's anybody else out there. The public can go out. People were out actually partying in the streets. Mm-hmm. And here's the government saying we're not going to give him his warnings because there's a danger to public safety. Now, what they were doing was trying to preempt, the administration, they were trying to preempt their political foes who in the underwear bombing case just a few years ago had hammered them over the head for saying, you're going to warn this guy, give him his Miranda warnings, that's wrong, he should be treated as an enemy combatant, blah, blah, blah. So they were trying to get ahead, the administration was, of the political wave, which, by the way, came anyway. But they were invoking the public safety exception well beyond the breaking point. Because once they were to ask this guy, and this is what they ultimately did, because the law enforcement people, not the politicians, were in charge of the questioning. If they asked the guy, are there any more bombs? Is there any more danger? Do you have any Confederates or co-conspirators? Is there anything else that's going to happen? He tells you no. That sort of confirms what the Boston police already seem to know from all the other evidence. There's no more public safety danger there. And yet the administration was treating this like it was going to be a continuing danger and they could interrogate him forever. And that was just wrong.
So you're saying that the Obama administration's interpretation of the public safety exception is suspect?
Yes, it's definitely suspect. They stretched it way, way out. There is such an exception laid down by the Supreme Court, but to say that this is sort of open-ended forever is just incorrect and misleading.
Were Tsarnaev's civil rights violated?
Not in any way that I know of. As I said, when the report eventually came out about what went on in those first few hours where he was able to answer questions with pencil and paper, they asked him the few questions, any more danger, any more bombs and so forth. He said no. They Mirandized him. Right? They didn't actually have to do that because keep in mind that it doesn't violate your rights not to be Mirandized. If they don't Mirandize him, they can't use in-custody statements, and he's clearly in custody. But there's no right to be Mirandized. There's no violation, in fact, of Miranda until we go to court sometime down the road and the government tries to get unwarranted statements into evidence.
So the police never have to read you these rights that you have. It's only when something you said to them without those rights having been given, if the prosecution wants to use that evidence in court, they then cannot if the rights were not read.
That's when the rubber meets the road. And that is what most people don't know about this, frankly.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. We're talking about Miranda rights and how they pertain to the Boston Marathon bombing suspect. Our number is 412-246-2002. 412-246-2002. Coming up, we'll take your calls. We'll talk more about the Miranda rights as they pertain to the Tsarnaev case and also how the Salinas versus Texas case tests Miranda rights when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking about Miranda rights, how they pertain in particular to the Boston Marathon bombing suspect. Our number 412-246-2002, if you'd like to join our conversation with Pitt Law Professor David Harris, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. We'd particularly like to hear from someone who has been arrested and had their Miranda rights read to them or not had them read to them and how that affected their case going forward. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. David, before we went to break, we were talking about the situation with Yohar Tsarnaev, the second suspect, the surviving suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing. And we were talking about the Obama administration's interpretation of the public safety exception in this case, which was made in order to try to get the suspect to talk before his Miranda rights were actually read to him, which they eventually were. And there was this push by a couple of senators, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who say that Tsarnaev should be treated as an enemy combatant.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about this particular idea that the senators here have?
Well, I think it's a mistake. Senator McCain is not a lawyer. Senator Graham is a lawyer. He should know better. What they're pushing for is to have him put into the military tribunal system for a trial and to have him declared an enemy combatant. That phrase originated in the Bush administration. The declaration of somebody as an enemy combatant means they're held in military custody, no access to a lawyer. And that's what Senator Graham was really on about. He said, you know, if the lawyers get to him, he'll never talk, and we really need the intelligence from this guy and so forth. But this is an American citizen,
right? They're both American soil.
Right. All right? And you simply cannot do that. I mean, that is beyond what even the Supreme Court reviewing the Guantanamo cases has said can be done. And you certainly can't put them in the military tribunal system. Senator Graham wrote that law. He should know better. And so there is no reason to do that. And furthermore, our civilian courts, our U.S. district courts, are plenty capable of trying terrorism cases. We've tried actually hundreds of them over the last 15 years. We've had great, great success with these cases, and it frankly showcases to the world our justice system, that we don't have to take shortcuts, we can be transparent, and we can get the job done. So I think calling for enemy combatant status in military trials is a mistake.
And you say that it shows disrespect for the law and the Constitution.
I really think so. I think, you know, it's not the Miranda thing especially. It's the idea that we can't cope with a case like this. We need a special exception, a special carve-out for something like this. Our rights have to take back seats for purposes of a big problem like terrorism. And that doesn't show the kind of respect our Constitution deserves. Our Constitution and our justice system has proven able to cope with these things, and woe unto us if we leave our own values behind when somebody's dropped a bomb in one of our cities.
Isn't this a pattern, though, that we've seen in the United States since 9/11?
Yes, it is. It is the very same pattern. When the danger is great, when there's a threat that we perceive, we're willing to trade off what freedom we have for a little security. But as Ben Franklin has reminded us so many times, you know, if you're willing to make that trade, you don't actually deserve liberty or security.
412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Joseph in Wilmerding. Joseph, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes. Hello?
Hi. Welcome to the show, Joseph.
Yes. I had a question on the comment about once they interview the terrorist in the Boston Marathon, where he said that once they ask him, is there any more bombs, and he says no, that the threat is gone. And I'm thinking, that's not true. He could be lying. So I would think, even if they have him in custody, and he says no, there's still a threat. So his rights shouldn't matter at that point, even with the Miranda rights or with the, whatever that other case was. And I'll take my answer off air if you understand it.
That's a good question. David, go ahead.
Yeah, I do understand it, Joseph. The fact was that not only did this guy tell them there were no other bombs or threats, but it confirmed what the Boston police knew from all of the other evidence they had, all the intelligence they had gathered. I'm not at all saying that they should necessarily just take his word, but the Boston police, everybody on scene, they were acting as if the threat had passed, and his statement really just confirmed it. If he could easily be lying, And if he said yes, there were bombs, certainly we'd have to act accordingly. But when he says no, and no lines up with everything else, I think you can assume that we're in good shape.
Now that we have a better understanding of what Miranda rights are, let's talk about the U.S. Supreme Court hearing the argument in Salinas versus Texas. What is this case about? What questions does it raise regarding Miranda rights?
Well, as I was saying early on, virtually since the day Miranda was decided, it has taken public flack, flack from politicians and so forth. Even though the police are not in the business of giving it flack because they know it really benefits them most of the time, Salinas is just the latest sort of salvo in that war. What that case, this case is about is whether the fact that somebody is silent before being advised of his rights, whether that can be used against him at trial. So here's how it sets up. Before the guy's arrested, before he is given his Miranda warnings, he doesn't say anything when he, in theory at least, could have. Now, the Constitution gives you the right to be silent. You don't have to be advised to be silent. You simply have that right to be silent. It's in the Fifth Amendment. All of us have it. And what the government wants to do in the Salinas case is use the fact that the man remains silent to imply his guilt and to tell the jury in his case, well, if he really wasn't guilty, why didn't he say anything? And that would be a burden on the Fifth Amendment and the Miranda warnings. Now,
that seems like a strange twist because you're using somebody's constitutional rights against their invocation of their rights against them.
Absolutely. And it leaves you with three very unappetizing choices. You can remain silent and have it used against you. You can lie and be charged with perjury. Or you can be forced into talking because you know that if you don't talk, it's going to be used against you. That's not how the Fifth Amendment was supposed to work. And I certainly hope that the Supreme Court turns back this idea that your silence can be used against you. The fact that the guy wasn't advised of his Miranda rights should have nothing to do with it.
Does that affect how the Salina case ought to be decided? If Miranda is much less of a protection than people think it is, how does that affect things going forward and the Supreme Court's decision?
Well, that's a great question, Paul. And I, you know, Miranda, as I've said, from the statistics, from my experience working in the field as both a defense lawyer and a prosecutor, from my many, many conversations with police officers and others in the criminal justice system, you know, I think Miranda doesn't actually give a lot of protection to those who need it. I would actually trade it in a heartbeat for a universal recording requirement and just having the police say, you don't have to talk to us. That's what they do in the UK. I think that would actually work better and make more sense. What this will do, if the Supreme Court goes this direction, is shoot another big hole in Miranda. And it's odd that they want to do that. The courts seem to be the only parties who are interested in weakening Miranda. Police have no interest in it. Prosecutors have no interest in it. Defense attorneys have no interest in it. Everybody knows that this works about as well as it could, and it never stops prosecutions cold.
When will we hear from the Supreme Court? When might we hear a decision in this case?
The Supreme Court will finish its term in the last week of June, so we will probably hear for a decision in Salinas, I would guess, well before that, because the last week is always reserved for the blockbusters. It'll be gay marriage and so forth.
David Harris is a distinguished faculty scholar and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. David, as always, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Paul. Good to be with you.